Stay with us after 9 on On Point. We'll have the latest on the mass shooting attacks this weekend in El Paso and Dayton. Shootings left at least 29 people dead, dozens injured. On Point has coverage starting after 9. 1A will continue our coverage after 1. But first, on a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're looking at some pieces of legislation that State Senator Andre Jacques has had a hand in this year, starting with a bill banning indoor vaping. He's been a leading author or sponsor of more than 50 bills introduced to the State Senate this year. Do you live in Appleton or Kewaunee or Door counties or another community that Senator Jacques represents? What questions do you have for him? Do you vape or do you know someone who does? Should indoor vaping be banned like cigarette smoking? You have a line at 800-642-1234. Andre Jacques is a Republican state senator from De Pere. Senator Jacques, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be back on the show, Kate.
Well, let's start with this bill you introduced in May, Senate Bill 245, which would change the definition of smoking in state law so vaping products and marijuana would fall under the state's existing ban on indoor smoking. Why doesn't vaping or smoking marijuana already fall under the state's indoor smoking ban?
Well, you know, it's just all about the definitions that we have in state law. And really, we're always looking to kind of update state law in different ways that weren't necessarily anticipated when laws were created. But the idea is to basically have safe, breathable air indoors. And that's certainly something that I understand as somebody who has a wife with asthma. And, you know, it's something that we're really learning more and more about e-cigarettes and vaping. And of course, these are devices that are becoming an epidemic among our youth population and causing just untold health effects that we're just learning more and more about. In fact, there are just reports out last week about not just the 8 that were hospitalized because of different substances that were put into e-cigarettes, but this is just something that I think is very common sense in terms of the next logical extension, something that we have a very broad coalition of support for from both sides of the aisle, as well as any number of groups, whether that's the American Cancer Society, the American Lung Association, American Heart Association, Tobacco Free Kids. So it's something that I'm very, very pleased to be part of a broad coalition. It's not one that I necessarily was the leading voice on, but something that I am happy to help it get to its destination.
Well, let's look at the voices now on marijuana. Governor Evers wants the state to allow medical marijuana, but we've heard Republican leaders in the state capitol, you know, having some mixed reaction on this. What is your position on medical marijuana?
Well, it's certainly something that I think as we look to expand the testing of marijuana for medical purposes at the FDA, which is something that I support, that, you know, going through that rigorous testing and finding out what is actually going to be the long-term health effects. I'm actually going to be touring later on today a hemp farm for somebody that produces CBD on his own under the state's program that has been set up. So it's something that, I still have concerns, especially looking at the experience that we've seen in other states where it's crept into earlier onset and in youth use. There haven't been enough appropriate standards set up, and you have increased drug driving skyrocketing. And so it's something that, I think you look at some communities that have really looked to basically allow for casual marijuana use within their city ordinances. And when you do that, of course, you still have the overlap in any case with federal law, and you can't really make something legal at the state level, which is still illegal at the federal level. And that's something that I think every state is going to have to deal with, and why I think you're really going to want to push for, some clarity at the federal level before states proceed too much further there. But I think, when you have individuals that in some cases are basically lighting up marijuana in situations where other people are going to have to breathe that secondhand and potentially health consequences, that's certainly something that was why we included it within the original draft of the legislation. We have a subsequent secondary draft that's circulating for co-sponsors right now that just came out last week that does not involve marijuana because of some of the concerns, I think, from folks that it might be a little bit too premature to include marijuana within the definition of what we're looking to do.
Senator Jock, just curious, what do you want to learn out of your tour to at the hemp farm?
Well, this is an individual that I have known for many years that operates a clothing company, and he's reached out into the CBD, and you know, I think I'm looking to see what he has to show me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do a lot of firsthand experience, and I'm always looking for, when we're looking at state regulations that are in place, where is government perhaps not meeting the common sense test? Where are we getting in the way of something, or is there, you know, really information that's, you know, duplicative or making it more difficult for certain things to take place? I know before we had some of the changes at the federal level in relation to CBD, there were difficulties with hemp and being able to get the seeds that were needed mm-hmm. in Wisconsin, and there were issues with an attorney general's opinion on that. So, you know, just looking for things like that.
Talking with State Senator André Jock, representing communities stretching from Appleton to Door County, what questions or comments do you have about issues such as indoor vaping, cash tips, off-road vehicles, sexual assault evidence? Join in at 800-642-1234. Have you driven an ATV or another recreational vehicle while drunk, or have you been affected by a drunk driver? What do you think should be the penalties for drunken use of recreational vehicles? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Senator, let's look at a couple bipartisan bills that involve driving off-road vehicles while intoxicated. Senate Bill 10 would increase the age where complete sobriety is required to drive a snowmobile from age 19 to 21. So snowmobiles are the only recreational vehicle where absolute sobriety, or not a drop law, as it's sometimes referred to, is currently set at age 19 and under. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, it was actually, so that proposal was originally merged into a larger proposal that also is moving forward. Actually, that and the second proposal, both were voted out unanimously from the Assembly Criminal Justice Committee last session. Now, I know it did draw a few dissenting votes this session, but it is something where right now in Wisconsin, you could actually have a first offense within a very short time period for your typical car or truck, an ATV or UTV, a snowmobile, and a boat. And in no case would it count as a repeat offense. And we're different from our neighboring states of Michigan and Minnesota in how we do that. And we have quite a few areas in which we are not uniform. So yes, with snowmobiling, we do not have absolute sobriety for snowmobiling. But in addition to that, there are a lot of different ways that our OWI laws are not tied together among different types of vehicles, unlike several other states, but certainly our neighboring states. And that can add for a real hodgepodge and a patchwork for law enforcement to be able to navigate. And unfortunately, we find that there are a lot of situations where you have serious injury resulting or death resulting from people who are operating motorized vehicles that are always going to have that possibility of destruction and life-changing, life-altering circumstances. People that are getting behind the wheel when they've had something to drink, and it's people that have had multiple vehicles where they have done that, and fortunately they have not had the restrictions on their license. And
let's pause.
Disastrous consequences.
Yeah, pause right there with State Senator André Jock of DePeer. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute. More State Cap on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with Republican State Senator André Jock here on The Morning Show. And you can join in, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for him? What issues do you think our state lawmakers should be working to address? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Morgan now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, good morning. you. Good morning, Senator.
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite make that out.
Oh, I'm sorry. Good morning. I was going to say good morning to you.
Good morning, Morgan.
No comments. Thank you. You know, it's a good luck to you on your ventures of getting educated on what the real deal is. But anyways, I'll just stick to the about baby laws. I mean, you say they're common sense, but, you know, like common, what is common sense the way you put it? But they, I think about all the harm of, you know, like, yeah, smoking cigarettes, how, you know, bad that is, but having, you know, vaping where maybe, you know, smoking sections because there's lounges where people can go and play checkers and, you know, in Racine, a nice place where you can, you know, buy products that help you or vapes. And, you know, a lot of these young people, they're not just vaping nicotine. They actually have already CBD or whatever products, you know, in it or whatnot. And there's a lot of proof out there on the internet, YouTube, whatnot, of how amazing cures, you know, that this plant and things have done, you know.
So Morgan is looking for places to be able to vape. This legislation would not give Morgan that opportunity. State Senator?
Well, obviously, we already have restrictions on cigarette use, and outdoor, you know, use is something that I think is permitted. And certainly when you talk about things like CBD, and I have voted for and supported the ability at the state level, both in terms of growing hemp, but also the use of cannabidiol oil, CBD. And, you know, but as far as trying to create more opportunities for people to vape, you know, use e-cigarettes in an indoor setting. Obviously, that's the intent of the legislation is to, as she was pointing out, there are sometimes any number of things that can be put into these pods that are vaped. Of course, we saw that have some very traumatic health consequences for a number of young individuals in Wisconsin in the last few weeks here. And there are a number of additional cases that are really being discovered on a just an ongoing basis by Department of Health Services and by the various agencies in terms of unanticipated health effects, just because there really hasn't been the testing on that as a delivery method and the different chemicals that are involved and just not knowing what chemicals are involved.
Let's go to Pat now, joining us in Madison. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator, for appearing on the show, and I certainly encourage doing something about vaping. But I have a question regarding alcohol. I don't know if you heard the series that Wisconsin Public Radio had a few months ago about the problems with alcohol in Wisconsin. And one of the comments made by a doctor in the rehab programs was they have been asking that the tax be increased on alcohol in Wisconsin and have gotten resistance. I've been wondering the same. Why are our taxes so low when it comes to sales tax on alcohol? Because I certainly think the money could be used on health issues, road issues, education, etc.
Pat, thanks for the call. Senator Jacques, what about the tax on alcohol?
Well, you know, certainly when you look at the different excise taxes or the sin taxes, certainly there was an increase within the most recent budget in regards to vaping, but there have been certainly proposals before when you're talking about tobacco and e-cigarettes. When you're talking about beer or alcohol taxes, that's certainly something that I think has, you know, the Joint Finance Committee, which ultimately makes those decisions in the budget, has been aware of that. But I think when it comes to alcohol and much more than just the proposal that I put forward relating to recreational vehicles, but I've worked very much on the drunk driving issue, and it's something that we need to treat with the seriousness that it deserves. And there are any number of proposals. I know that State Representative Jim Ott has put forward a number that I have been very supportive of. And I don't think it's just a funding issue. And certainly there are a lot of different things that we're able to do, whether that's with treatment courts or trying to drive interventions within the court system at an earlier point so you don't have the repeat offenses. But I think we also need to treat the first offenses with the seriousness that they deserve. And that's something that, again, there are a number of proposals, whether that is making first offense a crime, like basically every other, and it is every other state in the union already has, or whether it's requiring that at the very least on the first offense, rather than it being just a civil, basically a forfeiture, something that you could mail in the ticket for, that you would have to have an appearance in court and drive home the seriousness of that offense. So that's, you know, certainly I think something that there's probably more of a political path to victory on at the moment. But, you know, certainly the state has adjusted any number of taxes and fees. We certainly did within the most recent budget. If it's possible to talk briefly about the sexual assault survivor.
Yeah, I wanted to move on to Senate Bill 326 here, this Bill of Rights for Survivors of Sexual Assault. What changes do you want to see in our criminal justice system through this legislation?
Absolutely. And I've been very involved in victims' rights over the past several years. But this bill really, as 20 other states have already done, makes sure that we focus in on the dignity, respect, and ability to pursue justice for survivors of sexual assault. I've worked with RISE and their state chapter, Colleen Zolper, as well as the local sexual assault center advocates, just in terms of dealing with the fact that, you know, when you have survivors right now, they don't necessarily have the uniformity in terms of the information that they're provided. So we're focusing on providing up-to-date written and verbal information about rights, and that would be a right to every survivor, and also the ability to choose whether or not to undergo a forensic exam. They would have a right to bathe. They would have a decision as to whether or not to cooperate with law enforcement. But along with that, for people to be able to come forward, we would expand the length of storage of the sexual assault kits, as well as provide notification before destruction, which is something that doesn't happen in Wisconsin, which is very commonplace.
So up to 50 years or until an offender is released from prison?
Sure. And I mean, we might be modifying that to at least 20 years. I think the Attorney General has proposed up to 10 years in situations where a survivor does not immediately want to proceed forward with law enforcement. I think that it would make sense to go to at least 20 years in that situation. I know the Attorney General has been okay with the 50-year standard that we had proposed in cases where there is active prosecution that is being pursued. But I really think one of the key provisions as well, and we certainly heard this from survivors, is the right to have that kit tested within 90 days.
Do
and
you
that's
think
going to ensure that you don't have a backlog that's going to occur. And that's something that it really is critical, because otherwise you have a lot of survivors that are just kind of sitting back and not knowing the status of a prosecution.
Do you think the State Crime Lab has enough resources to meet that deadline up to 90 days, considering the lab has recently struggled to keep up with testing demands as it is?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that was a concern of mine. I toured the State Crime Lab to make sure that I got an answer to that very question. We did add some additional positions in the state budget. I supported additional ones in terms of the criminal justice funding initiative that we put forward in the budget. But the Attorney General himself told me that right now our state is at around 60 days in terms of our average processing. So certainly it's something that we are capable of providing that guarantee in the future for victims if we choose to focus on that. And right now the state of Massachusetts has a firm 30-day time limit in statute. Connecticut has a firm 60-day commitment. Again, that's about what the average is in Wisconsin. But altogether, there are 8 states, including Michigan, that have at least that 90-day standard that we're looking for, 8 states, including Michigan.
Well, as we wrap up here, let's look at this package of higher ed bills. Among other things, the bills would ban raising UW system tuition more than inflation and restrict student fees. Are there risks in reducing the flexibility that future lawmakers and universities could have with tuition?
Well, I think it's certainly a responsible standard, and certainly it would be a statutory standard that lawmakers could choose to try to make the case to the public as to why they would need to try to increase tuition at a higher rate than that. But the intent of the proposal is to prevent the skyrocketing tuition, particularly as what we've seen the last few times that a freeze has been lifted. So right now we are currently under the freeze. I have supported the freeze and keeping college affordable. There are a number of things, I think, within this proposal that help with that regard, in part because in the past, and this is as a student government leader at UW-Madison, I was there during the years where you saw significant double-digit tuition increases, and tuition was seen as an escape valve for not making some of the same difficult choices that other levels of government made, and it was basically balancing the system budget on the backs of students.
Senator Jacques,
student fees that are there as well. Sorry,
Senator Jacques, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thanks, Kate.
Andre Jacques is a Republican state senator from De Pere. State Capitol Report continues right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, we're getting up to speed on developments inside the halls of the state capitol. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We'll take developments one at a time, starting with the swearing-in of Supreme Court Justice Brian Hagedorn for a 10-year term. After that, we'll move on to a lawsuit challenging Governor Evers' partial vetoes of the state budget. So lots to discuss with your questions, your insights as we go, 800-642-1234. What do you think of the ideological makeup of the state Supreme Court and what it means for the cases in the future? What about the litigation over the governor's veto power? Do you think it's justified? We're at 800-642-1234. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, and she co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So Judge Brian Hagedorn was sworn into the state Supreme Court Thursday. Justice Hagedorn will serve 10-year term. What is the significance of his presence on the court?
So this is a big deal for conservatives because Justice Hagedorn is a conservative-backed candidate. He received a lot of support from conservative organizations during the campaign, and his swearing-in brings the partisan makeup of the court to 5-2 in favor of conservatives. So I spoke with a professor emeritus at the UW-Milwaukee, a frequent commenter on political science in Wisconsin, Mordecai Lee. And he talked a little bit about sort of the implications of that big of a majority for conservatives on the court.
This is a kind of a comfort level that gives conservatives a feeling that no matter what, they're always going to have a viable majority.
So basically what he was saying there is that one justice could, I think what he said was go rogue or sort of go off the reservation or whatever, maybe not agree with other conservative justices on a particular case. Mm. They could sort of decide to not be with the majority opinion and conservatives would still have the majority in cases. So it gives those individuals of that particular ideology just a little bit more room to kind of disagree with each other potentially and have a safe majority in cases.
And it was reportedly the most expensive state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin history. How much money was spent on this race?
So $3.7 million was spent in the state Supreme Court race. That is a full $1 million more than the last record, which was coincidentally set at the previous state Supreme Court race. So we're pretty steadily
building.
Yeah, these races are getting more expensive. And as we've said many times, more partisan. That's becoming kind of an emergent theme in these Supreme Court races. So perhaps there's a little bit of a, relationship there in terms of the money and the partisanship.
Another election for an incumbent seat will happen next April. What do we see there?
So this is a particularly interesting Supreme Court race because this is the re-election bid by conservative Justice Daniel Kelly, who was appointed to the court in 2016. It's particularly interesting because it's falling on the same day as the Democratic presidential primary. So a lot of political watchers believe that just the timing of that election will benefit the liberal-backed candidates.
Oh, there could be more traffic at the polls.
Exactly. Democratic voters tend to turn up more in presidential election years. It's obviously a Democratic presidential primary. So having this officially nonpartisan state Supreme Court race on the ballot when a lot of Democrats are showing up at the polls, they think, well, maybe that's going to help the liberal-backed candidate. This was something that people were looking kind of toward in the last Supreme Court race, because if Hagedorn hadn't won, this 2020 race coming up would have been an opportunity actually for liberals to take the majority of the court for the first time since 2011, I believe. Obviously, that's not the case. That election would just take it back to 4-3 if the liberal-backed candidate did win. But that's sort of setting it up down the line for potentially a change in the ideological balance of the court.
Do we know who is running against Justice Kelly?
So we do have two liberal candidates already announced, a Milwaukee law professor, a professor at Marquette, Ed Falone, and then a Dane County judge, Jill Karofsky, are both running.
So what happens next with Judge Hagedorn being on the court? What case will be before him first?
So I don't know off the top of my head what case will be before him first, but I do know that there are a number of big cases headed to the state Supreme Court. I think one we're going to talk about a little bit later has to do with the governor's veto powers. Mm-hmm. There's a strong possibility that the legislative maps in Wisconsin could end up before the state Supreme Court when they're drawn in 2021. So lots of big issues that are going to be heading to the court, certainly during Judge Hagedorn's tenure, Justice Hagedorn's tenure.
We're moving through developments at the state capitol with Laurel White. She is WPR's state capitol reporter. Democratic lawmakers are circulating bills that aim to have gun stores store their products in secure places after hours. Do you think this is a positive move, or do you think it won't do much to improve safety? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Moving on to this lawsuit, a conservative group called the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty filed a suit Wednesday over Governor Evers' veto powers. What is Will alleging?
So essentially what Will is saying in this lawsuit is that the governor's vetoes, particularly four of his vetoes, they singled out those four of the 78 that he issued, were just too far-reaching, too broad, had too much of a effect, should you say, on the legislative language. They said that basically what he did in their estimation was not alter the language that the legislature passed, but rather created new laws entirely. Hmm. They had a Capitol press conference about this, and this is how their president, Rick Essenberg, described the governor's vetoes.
Here we have what I might call a magician's veto, in which appropriation items that have been passed by the legislature have been transformed magically into something else.
It's pretty powerful, a magician's veto.
So we know that vetoes in Wisconsin get these snazzy names sometimes. We have the Vanna White veto that was outlawed, the Frankenstein veto. And so I think this is obviously an attempt by Will to kind of label this what they believe to be a new veto, which is a contentious subject in and of itself.
I don't know why it wasn't called the Harry Potter veto.
Right. You might need a little trademark, you know, a little suit from Warner Brothers or something if you mention that.
So, you know, why is Governor Evers' veto pen unique and powerful?
So the Wisconsin governor does have one of the most powerful veto pens in the country. You know, he can remove things, add things, words, punctuation, numbers. So, you know, obviously we mentioned some of those things that have been rolled back. The Vanna White veto, that was taking out individual letters and words. The Frankenstein veto, taking out words in adjacent sentences to make new sentences. So the powers have been trimmed back over the years. But certainly the Wisconsin governor does still maintain a strong veto. I think it's interesting to note kind of the pushback on this lawsuit from Democrats, and that is that the vetoes that Governor Evers put forward aren't substantially different, they believe, in substance from the vetoes that, say, Governor Walker put forward. They're saying, we believe Governor Walker's vetoes had the same sort of effect in terms of the amount of change that they put in place. And Will actually kind of acknowledged that during the press conference when they were rolling out this lawsuit. They said, we acknowledge other governors have done that before. But this isn't a partisan lawsuit, in our belief. We are just kind of pushing back to preserve what they called, you know, the balance of powers, the separation of powers. They said, we haven't had the capacity to bring this lawsuit before. this is just the time that we're doing it, but it's not about personalities or politics. It's about the principle of the thing.
Let's bring in David now in DeForest. Hi, David.
Hi. I wanted to ask that these laws and rules that they're challenging now, much like the lame duck rules, aren't these all rules that the Republicans first enacted in the first place?
So they're not rules that the Republicans enacted entirely, but I think you're kind of hitting on that theme a little bit that Democrats have talked about a lot and others have talked about as this lawsuit has come out, which is that Republican governors have certainly done the same things that Governor Evers did with his veto pen that this lawsuit is challenging. And that's something that the group bringing the lawsuit acknowledges. This isn't really a Democratic thing or a Republican thing. All governors have done this. They just believe that now's the time to kind of rein that in. I would really strongly suggest anybody that's interested in vetoes in Wisconsin and the history of vetoes to look up a report done, I think it was 2 months ago now, it was in June, by the Legislative Reference Bureau. And they actually outline the different vetoes that different governors have done over time. So you can sort of compare and see what governors have done and the magnitude of their changes, things like that. It's interesting.
Well, let's move on to gun storage. A package of bills is being circulated by Democratic lawmakers related to gun storage. One of those bills is centered on the way businesses store the guns they sell. What is this legislation? Can you tell us about it?
So this is a package of bills sponsored primarily by Representative Lisa Subek in the Assembly and Senator Fred Risser in the Senate. Those are both Madison area lawmakers. And I think kind of the biggest bill that rises to the top of this package, and I identify that because it's a bill that was first introduced during the last legislative session and actually got a hearing during that session, which is an indication that it might move forward in the legislative process. This is a bill that would require gun stores of all sizes across the state to lock up the guns after closing time. And this is in response to, I believe it was in 2016, there was that break-in at a Janesville gun store where an individual stole 18 weapons, and a number of those haven't been recovered yet. That led to a several-day manhunt across Wisconsin trying to find this individual. Representative Subek said that the legislation was in response to incidents like that and just sort of an overall culture of gun violence in the country.
We're moving through developments at the state capitol with WPR reporter who keeps tabs on it all, Laurel White, is here. Lawmakers have clashed over funding for mental health support for farmers. Does this issue hit home for you? And what about the issue over guns? Would you see that this legislation would make an impact? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democratic lawmakers are circulating bills that aim to have gun stores store their products in secure places after hours. Do you think this is a positive move, or do you think it won't do much to improve safety? Join in at 800-642-1234. WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Carol joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
My opinion on the guns is that a more central issue is conceal and carry. I am opposed. I think they should be opposed to conceal and carry because more people think that other people have guns now, so they think, I better go out and get a gun too, or I'm going to be in danger. So many people would be influenced if there were legislative action against conceal and carry.
Carol, thanks so much for calling in. Laurel, what do we see on that front?
Well, that's certainly something that we know that the Republican majority in Wisconsin is in strong favor of concealed carry in Wisconsin. So I think it would take a major sort of ideological shift for the party for that to change while Republicans still have the majority in the state legislature in Wisconsin. And we know that they have, particularly in the state assembly, a very strong majority that's likely to last for a while.
Well, going back to this gun storage legislation, where we left off, Democratic Representative Lisa Subek, you talked to her, and let's take a listen.
We have an epidemic of gun violence. And in too many instances, we're hearing about people who are already prohibited from owning a firearm, getting a hold of weapons and doing harm with them.
So is this what her bill is in response to? Getting a hold of weapons.
That's right. So I think I mentioned this before our break, but there was that incident in Janesville, and it was in 2017 where those 18 weapons were stolen from a Janesville gun store. There have been other incidents, you know, across the state where individuals break in and they're able to abscond with multiple weapons. It's obviously a way for individuals who aren't licensed to have a gun, who aren't able to legally have a gun in Wisconsin, to get their hands on those. So she believes that that's a way to just kind of put up another barrier.
What type of traction is she getting? What kind of support is this bill seeing right now?
So I didn't get a response from the leaders in the state legislature, either the assembly or the Senate. I also reached out to a number of Wisconsin gun groups to see if they wanted to weigh in on this proposal or other proposals in the package. They declined to do so, but we did get a statement from the National Rifle Association, which was pretty strongly opposed to this measure, as well as others. They called it a one-size-fits-all approach. I think their biggest argument against it was they didn't think that it was fair or appropriate for Milwaukee gun stores or gun stores in larger urban areas to have the same sort of requirements as smaller, more rural stores that might not have the same quantity of product or the same means to be able to provide these secure facilities.
So this legislation is a package of bills. What else is in the package?
Mm-hmm. So there's another provision. Actually, we got some input from the NRA on this one as well, that would require people who have a child in the home, if they have a gun, to lock up the gun in their at their property as well. So just some additional requirements for storage. Also some requirements for if a weapon is stolen, how long you have to report it, things like that. I think there are five bills in all in the package.
Have we seen this legislation before?
Yes, this is all legislation that was introduced for the first time during the last legislative session, but there was only one bill that received a hearing, and that was the storage in stores legislation, but it didn't make it very far in the process after that.
And I'm sure we'll be watching this very closely given the traumatic events this weekend.
Absolutely. This is a very timely discussion, and I think it's something that we're going to be hearing a lot about moving forward.
Let's look at mental health services for farmers, a program to help homeless people also gain job skills. What are these proposals trying to do?
So these are two different proposals that were actually approved as part of the state budget. So they are provisions that provide funding to different state agencies for different programs. The Farmer Mental Health Program is about $200,000 that goes to an entity that has been doing outreach to farmers for quite a while about a variety of issues. But this would kind of beef up the work that they do surrounding mental health, which is something that farmers and agriculture groups have said is sorely needed now as the industry faces some challenges. The homeless job training is a program. It's a skills-based program that provides homeless individuals with training so they might be able to seek employment in certain areas. Now, again, these are things that were approved as part of the state budget, but what's kind of wonky is that some elements of the budget have to go back to the state budget writing committee for another layer of approval before they're released to these departments. So these are two of those things. It's kind of a bit more than a handful, sort of two handfuls, maybe, of this kind of program. And they went back to the budget committee just a couple weeks ago. And the reason that they're in the news is that they weren't approved at that time. There's been a little bit of a delay in getting these funds released.
Well, since there's so much focus right now on what is happening this past weekend with the 29 deaths and the deadly shooting, let's bring in Carol in Fish Creek with some observations. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm so discouraged by our lawmakers. I think so it's such a huge common sense thing. Lock the guns up at the store, lock the guns up at home, and if you have a gun stolen, report it. You're not hurting the people who want guns. You're saving the people who could be hurt by guns. And any lawmaker who doesn't want to take that common sense step, vote them out.
Karen, thanks for calling in. So Karen really feels this legislation is pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that, you know, as we mentioned before, this is obviously going to be an ongoing conversation in the state capitol. There have been other pieces of legislation other than this package that we're talking about today that have been introduced related to guns in Wisconsin. People that are interested in this particular new package, as I mentioned, that's Representative Subek from Madison, Senator Risser, from Madison. I think that this isn't a conversation that's going to end anytime soon.
Well, let's look at Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who took some heat after he declined to allow Democratic Representative Jimmy Anderson the ability to phone into committee meetings. What happened there last week?
So Speaker Voss, this is a conflict that's been going on for a couple weeks, but last week Speaker Voss released a letter in response to Representative Anderson's request saying that he wasn't going to meet it. He said that he has some concerns about lawmakers being able to call into legislative meetings because he believes it's disrespectful to members of the public that come in to testify on bills. So he said that that's a policy that's applicable to the state assembly that he believes should stay in place. However, he was willing to explore some other accommodations for Representative Anderson, including allowing some lawmakers to vote by paper ballot for committee meetings, which means you can vote remotely. You don't have to be physically present to vote on a bill for a committee. He also said that he was willing to arrange a videographer for the representative to come in and film these meetings and provide that tape to him so he was able to watch the meetings he couldn't attend. Representative Anderson is paralyzed from the chest down, so he says that that disability makes it difficult for him to sit for long periods of time to attend some of these meetings. But he said that Representative Anderson said some of these provisions that Speaker Voss proposed really aren't satisfactory. He said that the videotaping offer is particularly troublesome because it wouldn't allow him to interact during the meeting. He wouldn't be able to ask any questions of members of the public that come in to testify. He wouldn't be able to talk with other lawmakers during this process. So he said essentially that's kind of reducing him to a bystander at this committee meeting rather than the sort of active lawmaker participant role he wants to play.
Laurel, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Just ahead, we talk about the free and reduced lunch program and disparities in the program across the state. And stay with us after 9 for coverage of the deadly weekend shootings in El Paso and Dayton. On Point, we'll start our coverage after 9. 1A, we'll continue it after 1. We hear from you about what you're thinking and feeling after a deadly week in our country. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.